File 39. It was, for example, a fundamental mistake to ridicule the worth of the enemy, as the Austrian and German comic papers made a chief point of doing in their propaganda. The very principle here is a mistaken one, for when they came face to face with the enemy, our soldiers had quite a different impression. Therefore, the mistake had disastrous results. Once the German soldier realized what a tough enemy he had to fight, he felt that he had been deceived by the manufacturers of the information which had been given him. Therefore, instead of strengthening and stimulating his fighting spirit, this information had quite the contrary effect. Finally, he lost heart. On the other hand, British and American war propaganda was psychologically efficient. By picturing the Germans to their own people as barbarians and Huns, they were preparing their soldiers for the horrors of war and safeguarding them against illusions. The most terrific weapons which those soldiers encountered in the field merely confirmed the information that they had already received, and their belief in the truth of the assertions made by their respective governments was accordingly reinforced. Thus, their rage and hatred against the infamous foe was increased. The terrible havoc caused by the German weapons of war was only another illustration of the Hunnish brutality of those barbarians. Whereas on the side of the Entente, no time was left the soldiers to meditate on the similar havoc which their own weapons were capable of. Thus, the British soldier was never allowed to feel that the information which he received at home was untrue. Unfortunately, the opposite was the case with the Germans, who finally wound up by rejecting everything from home as pure swindle and humbug. This result was made possible because at home they thought that the work of propaganda could be entrusted to the first ass that came along, braying of his own special talents, and they had no conception of the fact that propaganda demands the most skilled brains that can be found. Thus, the German war propaganda afforded us an incomparable example of how the work of enlightenment should not be done, and how such an example was the result of an entire failure to take any psychological considerations whatsoever into account. From the enemy, however, a fund of valuable knowledge could be gained by those who kept their eyes open, whose powers of perception had not yet become sclerotic, and who, during 4.5 years, had to experience the perpetual flood of enemy propaganda. The worst of all was that our people did not understand the very first condition which has to be fulfilled in every kind of propaganda, namely a systematically one-sided attitude towards every problem that has to be dealt with. In this regard, so many errors were committed, even from the very beginning of the war, that it was justifiable to doubt whether so much folly could be attributed solely to the stupidity of people in higher quarters. What, for example, should we say of a poster which purported to advertise some new brand of soap by insisting on the excellent qualities of the competitive brands? We should naturally shake our heads. And it ought to be just the same in a similar kind of political advertisement. The aim of propaganda is not to try to pass judgment on conflicting rights, giving each its due, but exclusively to emphasize the right which we are asserting. Propaganda must not investigate the truth objectively, and in so far as it is favorable to the other side, present it according to the theoretical rules of justice. Yet it must present only that aspect of the truth which is favorable to its own side. It was a fundamental mistake to discuss the question of who was responsible for the outbreak of war and declare that the sole responsibility could not be attributed to Germany. The sole responsibility should have been laid on the shoulders of the enemy, without any discussion whatsoever. And what was the consequence of these half-measures? The broad masses of the people are not made up of diplomats or professors of public jurisprudence, nor simply of persons who are able to form reasoned judgment in given cases, but a vacillating crowd of human children who are constantly wavering between one idea and another. As soon as our own propaganda made the slightest suggestion that the enemy had a certain amount of justice on his side, then we laid down the basis on which the justice of our own cause could be questioned. The masses are not in a position to discern where the enemy's fault ends and where our own begins. In such a case, they become hesitant and distrustful, especially when the enemy does not make the same mistake, but heaps all the blame on his adversary. Could there be any clearer proof of this than the fact that finally our own people believed what was said by the enemy's propaganda, which was uniform and consistent in its assertions, rather than what our own propaganda said? And that, of course, was increased by the mania for objectivity which addicts our people. Everybody began to be careful about doing an injustice to the enemy, even at the cost of seriously injuring and even ruining his own people and state. Naturally, the masses were not conscious of the fact that those in authority had failed to study the subject from this angle. The great majority of a nation is so feminine in its character and outlook that its thought and conduct are ruled by sentiment rather than by sober reasoning. This sentiment, however, is not complex, but simple and consistent. It is not highly differentiated, but has only the negative and positive notions of love and hatred, right and wrong, truth and falsehood. Its notions are never partly this and partly that. English propaganda especially understood this in a marvelous way and put what they understood into practice. They allowed no half measures which might have given rise to some doubt. Proof of how brilliantly they understood that the feeling of the masses is something primitive was shown in their policy of publishing tales of horror and outrages which fitted in with the real horrors of the time, thereby cleverly and ruthlessly preparing the ground for moral solidarity at the front, even in times of great defeats. Further, the way in which they pilloried the German enemy as solely responsible for the war, which was a brutal and absolute falsehood, and the way in which they proclaimed his guilt was excellently calculated to reach the masses, realizing that these are always extremist in their feelings. And thus it was that this atrocious lie was positively believed. The effectiveness of this kind of propaganda is well illustrated by the fact that after 4.5 years, not only was the enemy still carrying on his propagandist work, but it was already undermining the stamina of our people at home. That our propaganda did not achieve similar results is not to be wondered at, because it had the germs of inefficiency lodged in its very being by reason of its ambiguity. And because of the very nature of its content, one could not expect it to make the necessary impression on the masses. Only our feckless statesmen could have imagined that on pacifist slops of such a kind, the enthusiasm could be nourished which is necessary to enkindle that spirit which leads men to die for their country. And so, this product of ours was not only worthless, but detrimental. No matter what an amount of talent employed in the organization of propaganda, it will have no result if due account is not taken of these fundamental principles. Propaganda must be limited to a few simple themes, and these must be represented again and again. Here, as in innumerable other cases, perseverance is the first and most important condition of success. Particularly in the field of propaganda, placid aesthetes and blasé intellectuals should never be allowed to take the lead. The former would readily transform the impressive character of real propaganda into something suitable only for literary tea parties. As to the second class of people, one must always beware of this pest, for in consequence of their insensibility to normal impressions, they are constantly seeking new excitements. Such people grow sick and tired of everything. They always long for change, and will always be incapable of putting themselves in the position of picturing the wants of their less callous fellow creatures in their immediate neighborhood, let alone trying to understand them. The blasé intellectuals are always the first to criticize propaganda, or rather its message, because this appears to them to be outmoded and trivial. They are always looking for something new, always yearning for change, and thus they become the mortal enemies of every effort that may be made to influence the masses in an effective way. The moment the organization and message of a propagandist movement begins to be orientated according to their tastes, it becomes incoherent and scattered. It is not the purpose of propaganda to create a series of alterations in sentiment with a view to pleasing these blasé gentry. Its chief function is to convince the masses, whose slowness of understanding needs to be given time in order that they may absorb information. And only constant repetition will finally succeed in imprinting an idea on the memory of the crowd. Every change that is made in the subject of a propagandist message must always emphasize the same conclusion. The leading slogan must, of course, be illustrated in many ways and from several angles. But in the end, one must always return to the assertion of the same formula. In this way alone can propaganda be consistent and dynamic in its effect. Only by following these general lines and sticking to them steadfastly, with uniform and concise emphasis, can final success be reached. Then one will be rewarded by the surprising and almost incredible results that such a persistent policy secures. The success of any advertisement, whether of a business or political nature, depends on the consistency and perseverance with which it is employed. In this respect also, the propaganda organized by our enemies set us an excellent example. It confined itself to a few themes, which were meant exclusively for mass consumption, and it repeated these themes with untiring perseverance. Once these fundamental themes and the manner of placing them before the world were recognized as effective, they adhered to them without the slightest alteration for the whole duration of the war. At first, all of it appeared to be idiotic in its impudent assertiveness. Later on, it was looked upon as disturbing. But finally, it was believed. But in England, they came to understand something further, namely, that the possibility of success in the use of this spiritual weapon consists in the mass employment of it, and that when employed in this way, It brings full returns for the large expenses incurred. In England, propaganda was regarded as a weapon of the first order, whereas with us, it represented the last hope of a livelihood for our unemployed politicians and a snug job for shirkers of the modest hero type. Taken all in all, its results were negative.